assumed identities, characters who are reinventing themselves and mm-hmm. Counter lives that they're creating.
Right.
Tell us what fascinates you about that in A Life in Men.
I mean, so many things. You know, I've noticed that almost all my characters since I first started writing when I was, you know, well, I've been writing my entire life, but my first short stories when I was in college, that reinvention has always been somehow an emotional theme in my work. And I think I just am fascinated by the idea that we're many different people over a lifetime and the way we constantly are re-spinning ourselves and trying to become either closer to who we think we should be or sometimes further from who we thought we should be and therefore lived for other people. So,
well, there's this fascinating juxtaposition between, I mean, if you just look at what the book is about, it seems like it's, and it is, it's full of a lot of tragedy. There's terminal illness, there's drug addiction, there's terrorism, there's sexual violence, but the actual experience of reading the book, it feels like it's pulsing with life and with opportunity, with an opportunity for transformation at any moment. And these characters are compelling, I think, partly because despite all of these challenges and unexpected tragedies, they seem to find a way to rise above that circumstance and still have choice.
Yeah, I mean, that. Thank you, first of all, because that's a beautiful reading. That would be kind of my dream reading of the book. I mean, that's exactly what I hoped people would feel reading it. I didn't want it to be some dark read, and yet there are. I mean, the main character has a life-shortening illness, and you know that from page one. So clearly, you know, between that and the fact that, you know, Lockerbie is in here, and, you know, as you said, there are violent acts of various types that appear throughout the book. But I think that is exactly what I wanted to explore, is how do individuals who are sort of thrown into this larger world, you know, I mean, Mary and Nix don't have any direct relationship with any of the things that cause the violence, but, you know, they're sort of thrown around by it. But how does individual choice manifest when you're an individual on the global stage? You know, how do you continue to have control over your own destiny and your own perception, how you see your life, how you see choice, how you see transformation and connection? I think probably particularly individual connection and the how we give meaning to our own existence, you know, and marry someone who everyone had thought she would live on a very small canvas, and her efforts are mainly about living on a larger canvas. But when you leave your small canvas, it's also a lot less safe. And, you know, at times her actions may seem to be almost self-destructive. But in embracing choice and embracing the meaning of what she's looking for, she has to take certain risks.
Well, let's let our listeners hear a little bit of the prose from A Life in Men.
I'm going to start right from the very beginning. It's a chapter that is called Where Are We Going? Where Have We Been? And it takes place in Greece in 1988. Pretend I'm not already dead. That isn't important anyway. It's just that from here, I can see everything. There we are, see? Or should I say, there they are. Two girls sitting at a cafe off Taxi Square, eating anchovies lined up in a small puddle of oil on a white plate. Both girls are obsessed with salt. Since arriving in Mykonos, they have ordered anchovies every day, lunch and dinner. As a result, they are constantly thirsty. They carry large bottles of water with them everywhere, written on in Greek lettering, the blue caps peeking out of the tops of their beach bags along with their rolled-up beach mats. The curly-haired blonde girl, Mary, jokes to the straight-haired blonde girl, Nix, that this influx of salt is going to be a turnoff should they pick up any hot men. Mary has cystic fibrosis, and sometimes one of the first clues parents get that their baby has CF is that the child's sweat is especially salty, so much so that the baby tastes like a pretzel on the parent's lips. Apparently, Mary's parents, who are not her biological parents, so this is particularly strange, share her affinity for salt, because no one noticed that Mary was an odd-tasting baby, and for this reason, along with a variety of other factors, like her ability, unusual in CF patients, to digest her food, the disease was not diagnosed until she was 17. Today, as they sit at the tiny sidewalk cafe, Mary places an anchovy on her long pink tongue and lets it lie there while she savors its taste. Several postcards lie strewn on the tabletop between them, and Nix picks one up without looking at the photo on the front. Hand trembling slightly from her caffeine and nicotine buzz, she begins doodling idly, sketching a box inside another box. Inside the outer box, Nix writes, "Anonymously tragic story of terminal illness in boring Midwest." Then, inside the smaller inner box, she scribbles in tiny lettering, "Glamorous story of young women on holiday in sunny Greece equals story suitable for chick flick." "Who are you writing to?" Mary asks, her hand reaching across the marble tabletop, but Nix withdraws the postcard quickly, abruptly aware that there is no one on earth to whom she could send such a card, except, of course, to Mary herself. She knows that if she showed her doodle to Mary, Mary would laugh, and yet Nix finds herself tucking the card back into her book inside her beach bag instead. "Nobody," she says.
We're talking today to Gina Frangello, the author of A Life in Men from Algonquin Books. Did you have to do a lot of research for the cystic fibrosis
yes.
part? I mean, you really go into detail, convincing detail of what it means to be living with that condition.
I did a lot of research, and I think that as with many things in writing, I learned a lot so that I could also learn where I wanted to depart. I purposely gave Mary a very rare form of CF because I didn't want the book to make any attempt to be sort of like the embodiment of what it is to have CF, or, you know, like sort of the spokesperson for CF. I don't have CF. And so it was really important to me that there also be some element of creative license. But I did a great deal of research, and the research morphed over the years because it began really with like sort of medical reference books and things like that. And then as the internet just continued to explode, it really progressed to where I was reading much more personal things like people's blogs. And so, you know, it was a wide array of research.
Well, both in your dedications at the beginning and in the afterword to A Life in Men, you invite the question of autobiography and the ways in which this book does and doesn't overlap with your own personal experience. Can you talk a little bit about what you share in the book, in the afterword, and dedication, and how that interplays and doesn't with how the narrative unfolds?
Yes, mainly I talk about two things. Well, first of all, probably the main way in which the book is autobiographical has to do with place, because all the places in the book that Mary lives and goes are places where I have lived or spent a great deal of time, sometimes quite literally, like Arthog House, the squat, the sort of one step above a squat she lives in London, is a place I lived. You know, the Latchmere pub where she bartends, I bartended. I mean, just the places are very literally factual. However, in the essay after the book, I talk also about the fact that I lived with a woman who had cystic fibrosis in college, who was the original inspiration for my wanting to write about a character who was an avid traveler who also had a pretty severe physical limitation and health condition. And so she was a big inspiration. And then unfortunately, about 1 month after the book sold, my best girlfriend was diagnosed with stage 3C ovarian cancer, and she passed away within 4 months of that diagnosis. And so it was very strange in the sense that my own life began to mimic aspects of the book in terms of how we deal with the loss of a friend, how we deal with illness, and all of those things that Mary and Nix both faced.
And I would assume you dedicated the book to this friend who unexpectedly passed away, though the friend themselves wasn't their death wasn't informing the book.
Exactly, correct. The book is dually dedicated to my friend who originally inspired the concept, but who basically nothing in the book is based on her life other than the fact that she was a traveler who had cystic fibrosis. It's dually dedicated to her and to my friend Kathy, who passed away, yeah.
Well, one of the other interesting juxtapositions that I think really serves the book well is the book really is an intimate portrayal of love and loss and friendship. And yet, like you say, it has a sort of an epic scope in terms of where it goes. Geographically speaking, we go to Kenya, to Morocco, to the Canary Islands, Greece, Amsterdam, England, United States. I'm sure I'm missing somewhere, but it's this really intimate and interior thing that is happening across this large landscape.
Right.
That something that you knew you were going to write? Did you crave for that as you put the book together, or did it happen as in the process of putting it together?
I don't know that I would know how to write a book that wasn't pretty intimate. I mean, I get very obsessively into the heads of my characters when I write about them. They seem a lot more real to me than the people in my actual life for a period of time. So I wasn't going in it with the idea that I wanted to try to be extremely interior. I think that's just the way I write, but I was very interested in the concept of what it meant to live a deeply personal life on a large canvas, as I said before. And I think, for example, the end of the book, The White Hotel, D.M. Thomas's The White Hotel, where you've been sort of in this really deep psychoanalytic, very personal drama with this woman. And then at the very end of the book, suddenly she is sort of absorbed into just, you know, being one more person who's impacted by the Holocaust and by concentration camps, and just the juxtaposition of sort of the way the global and we all experience our lives as so singular, but we're all kind of on a swarming anthill. And that juxtaposition is really interesting to me in books that I've read, and I think I wanted to work with that here.
Oh, that's really fascinating. And you won a literary scholarship that ended up changing part of the book.
Yes.
In terms of Kenya becoming quite central and even you pulling the book back from submitting it to publishers.
Yes, correct. I had won the Summer Literary Seminars contest and was sent to Kenya in 2010. And I ended up staying. You're sent over for 2 weeks for their seminars. And I stayed for a month. And I basically just had such an intense sense the entire time I was there that Mary had been in Kenya and how exactly it had impacted her and who she had been there with and how old she had been at the time and you know, what period of time it had been. And all of that made no sense with regard to the current at that time timeline of the book. It was impossible to just go home and sort of integrate it, you know, unobtrusively in. It really required rewriting the entire book and changing everything around. It really changed Mary's character a lot as well.
And in Kenya, you studied with Mary Gateskill, right?
No, Mary Gateskill is the one who selected my story as the winner. I would have loved to study with Mary Gateskill, as I worship her, but I studied with the also fabulous Teresa Boda.
We're talking today with Gina Frangello, the author of A Life in Men from Algonquin Books. Well, speaking of Mary Gateskill, this book, like a lot of her writing, feels very sexual and feels like there's a lot of sexual desire and it feels very integrated into the world. I know a lot of writers have trepidation around writing about sex because it can be done so poorly.
Right.
And it stands out so horribly when it's done poorly. Mm-hmm. And yet it feels like you both excel at writing it and that it is just part of the world of A Life in Men. Can you talk about writing about sexuality if there were people that you admire in reading?
Well, Gateskill's a big one. I mean, yeah. I love Gateskill. She was really formative to what I saw people being able to do in their work when I was reading in my early 20s. Certainly Kundera, who's a very sexual writer, I mean, in a very, very different vein. But both of them, I think, you know, sex is simply part of both the interior and the social landscape for their characters in their books. And probably for most of my favorite books and writers, it really is. I mean, I don't think of it as like, okay, now is the time to write a sex scene and this is the one place where the character will think about sex or, you know, will perceive desire. I mean, we all live lives where, you know, sexuality is a huge part of who everybody is, even if it's thwarted sexuality, frustrated sexuality, inactive sexuality. It's simply part of the human psyche. And I think in some ways it's interesting because, of course, this is always pointed out to me that, that my work is sexual, although not always very explicit, but sexual in, I think, a psychological sense. And it's hard for me to even say why that is, because I guess I don't on some level understand why so many writers are have such cold feet about it. It's something that almost everyone's an authority on, really. You know, we don't have to read blogs and reference books to write about sex, you know? Sure. So.
Yeah, and it's refreshing to see it there. It's for me, at least.
Thank you.
So you also write about, you write from the point of view of men in this book as well.
More men than women, yes.
And how was that for you? And how was it writing about from the point of view of men in general? And also, how was it writing about from the point of view of men and their sexual desire?
Well, I have written from the point of view of men before, although not dominantly. I mean, most of my point of view characters have been women. This was the first time that the male point of views actually outnumbered the female point of views. It was great. I mean, I, like most writers, I love human psychology. I love hearing other people's stories. Many of my closest friends my entire life have always been men. And I just think that it was really fascinating for me to have the opportunity to portray so many men in this, because I think sometimes when a woman tries to write a male point of view, it seems as though one man is somehow, you know, and this is what men are like, you know, and I did not want to do that. And so, you know, I had in the past, in an unpublished novel, I had done sort of a she says, he says type of thing where it was, you know, the man and the woman both had a first-person point of view. And that, to me, felt as almost as though I was censoring myself. Like, every time he thought something, was my reader going to think that this is what I think every man thinks or something? And in this case, I was able to lose myself much more in the individual men and never think about that, because there were so many of them that no one of them was supposed to embody anything more than himself.
Yeah, and they were very different from each other, for sure, as a reader. Can you tell us a little bit more about the title? Is it purely ironic, or are there some other...
No, certainly. I mean, it's not purely ironic. I mean, Mary travels all over the world. The book takes place in 9 countries besides the United States. And during each section of her life, in each location, she is very impacted by a particular man. And they're not all lovers or anything like that. I mean, one is her brother, one is her biological father. You know, some are friends, one is her husband, some are lovers. And so, you know, that is quite literal. I mean, she's very impacted by the really intimate array of relationships she has with men in her life, and the geography and the relationships tended to overlap in ways that were interesting to me.
So can you talk a little bit, Gina, about literary influences for you in general? I know in a previous interview you'd pointed to E.L. Doctorow's Book of Daniel.
I love that book. I'm obsessed with that book.
I haven't read it, but
I teach it constantly. I mean, you know, anyone who's interested in point of view, I mean, you want to read that book because it just makes your head explode. And you're like, particularly if you're reading, I mean, it was written in the early 70s and I read it in the mid 90s. And so, I mean, I think in both of those cases, even more so than now, like I read it and my head just exploded. Like, people were doing this in 1971. You know, he has a basic premise of a guy who is writing his doctoral thesis, but it's not really his thesis, it's the novel. But the narrator, which is him, you know, continually shifts between first and third person. And it's also just a volatile, really emotional, really raw book. And so both in terms of the emotional energy, which I was reading during a time in the 90s when I think, like, there was a lot of cool distance in many books. And while some of it was intellectually fascinating, like, I like a book that's hot. I like a book that's volatile. And so, yeah, it's one of my favorite books.
Are there any other books that you went to in putting a life in men into being?
Well, definitely. I mean, I reread a lot of Kundera before I started writing because I wanted to really think a lot about the editorial omniscient point of view, when I think he's really, you know, a modern master of it. But ultimately, I didn't do much of what he did. It was just sort of background. But you know, many books. I mean, while I was in Kenya, I was reading Francesca Marciano's Rules of the Wild, which is one of my favorite books. And I think the sensuality of that book, and also the intense loyalty between female friends, and just the way we adjust to a landscape that isn't our own, that was an influence during the later parts of writing the book.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Other Voices book, the press that you're a longtime editor of?
Yes. I actually stepped down in September from Other Voices Books, but Other Voices Books has been a great, vibrant indie press since 2005. It's now run by DeZank Books. So it continues to survive, just not with me at the helm. But we have some of my favorite writers. I've had the opportunity to work with people like Todd Goldberg and Rob Roberge and Zoe Zolbrod and Allison Amen, you know, just people who I had admired as a publisher of short fiction and had wanted to do books with them. And it's just really probably been the ride of my professional life to do Other Voices books.
So what is next on your agenda? What are your upcoming or current projects?
Well, I'm most of the way through a first draft of a new novel called Every Kind of Wanting, and I'm touring like a lunatic, and you know, I have the new teaching gig, and I'm at the Rumpus every Sunday and curating fiction at the Nervous Breakdown, and I have three kids all under high school age. So basically, if my head doesn't catch fire sometime really soon, that's where you can find me.
And can you tell us a little bit about your new book that you're working on, and how like writing A Life in Men has informed the choices you're making around the new one?
Yes, definitely. The new novel also has a kind of editorial omniscient and roving panoramic point of view, but in a very different way. And so I guess I'm continuing to play with that form. You know, I'm sure that not every book I ever write is going to have a variation on that. But right now I seem to be pretty obsessed with it. It would be hard for me to go back to something like a close limited third or a first person narrative right now. I seem to be thinking in this sort of panoramic way. The novel concerns, on the surface, the plot of the book is about a gestational surrogacy, a gay couple and the gestational surrogate who they work with to have their baby. But in reality, it spans 30 years. Part of it takes place in Venezuela. It's all about family secrets and, you know, who owns love.
That sounds fantastic. Thanks for being on Between the Covers today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We were talking today with Gina Frangello, the author of A Life in Men from Algonquin Books. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Bear Witness, a storytelling night to celebrate the release of Extra Tough number 6.75, Report from Uyak Bay, Thursday, March 20th, 7 p.m. at the Jack London Bar, 529 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. Bear Witness features Vanessa Rennick, Laura Messersmith-Glavin, Mo Baustern, Judith Arcana, and Tim Griffey. Again, that's Thursday, March 20th at 7 p.m. at the Jack London Bar. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
No matter how long we live, we never have enough time for the people we love and the things we want to do. Some of us can only afford to leave stories and memories behind. But if your life's been prosperous, please remember KBOO when you plan your estate. Your bequest will keep peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and a commitment to social change alive on Portland's airwaves here at your community radio station, KBOO.
bouton de son par-dessus, un bouton d'imperméable sur ses deux indélouables.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today in the studio, we are joined by Benjamin Renner, who is the co-director of the new animated feature film, Ernest and Celestine, which recently won the César, the French Oscar, for an animated feature. Benjamin, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Now, this feature, Ernest and Celestine, is about to open March 14th in the U.S. It's already had a run in Europe. Has it been well-received?
Yeah, really well. It was released in 2012, on the 12th of December, and it was really good success, because in France it was released at the same time as Wreck-It Ralph and big American movie, and we really thought it would be not good. We would be smashed by all those big movies. But we had 1 million people coming to see the film, which is really great for a French film. So we are really happy of the reaction of the audience.
Well, I'm not sure that Americans are quite as familiar with the books that the film is based on, the Ernest and Celestine books. There were something like 30 of these books, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, because it's an adaptation of books. The author was, because she passed away in 2000, she did it between 1980 to until 2000. And yeah, it must be around 30 books. But she also made other books. Not with Ernest and Celestine, like A Day, a Dog, and very beautiful books as well.
Now, Gabrielle Vincent is the name of the author, and she started out as a fine artist, a painter, and she was a bit reluctant to become a children's book illustrator and author.
Yeah, at the very beginning, she was not really into it, but she was convinced by a friend to make one. And she did, but she changed her name because her real name is Monique Martin. She changed her name so all her artist friends shouldn't know that she made an illustration book for children. And it was such a huge success that she finally accepted that it was okay to do that. So that's why she started making more and more and more. And it was definitely worth it, I think.
So it was considered a bit déclassé to be an illustrator when you could make paintings and fine art and gallery work.
Yeah, in her mind it was like this, but I totally don't think it's the case. I think it's really good to be an illustration for children.
Well, obviously, the French-speaking audiences didn't think so either, because Ernest and Celestine became an enormous hit as books. And tell us a little bit about the world of Ernest and Celestine, the characters that became so beloved.
Well, in the books, it's a simple story of Ernest and Celestine living together. So Ernest is a big bear, and Celestine is a very young mice, little girl. She must be 5 or 6 or 7. And they just live together. The stories are really short, like Ernest is sick and Celestine is taking care of him. And it's always really sensitive stories where you feel a lot of emotions. And we based the film on one particular book, which is called The Birth of Celestine, where Ernest, it's the book that depicts the how Ernest met Celestine and how he met her in a trash can while she was a baby, and he took care of her and he raised her. So we took this book as a starting point to write the film, but the film is quite different. The story is quite different because it's more like how we start in a world that really is like our own, like realistic, like dark and with mean people, with like a mean world, dark world, and how it becomes like what Gabrielle Vincent was doing in her books, like a more like a cocoon world, like two person living together in a perfect paradise. So that's how we try to see the film.
Well, the film that you co-directed with Stéphane Aubière and Vincent Pattard, these two worlds, the worlds of the bears and the worlds of the mice, are really fully realized. And one change that you made from the Gabrielle Vincent books were that you had whole communities of bears and mice, where the bears were various ages of adults and children, and so were the mice. Whereas in the books by Miss Vincent, the bears tended to be adults and the mice were children.
Yeah, exactly. So we changed that so we could have this, as I said, these two societies fighting one against each other. That's something that the writer of a film...
That would be, let's see...
Daniel Pennac. He's quite famous in France. He's a very famous French novelist. He writes wonderful novel. And he wanted to make something more cynical, so he took those two society, bears and mice, that hate each other. In the books, bears and mice live with each other, so it's perfect. But he wanted to explain how a bear and a mice can live. Because bears, of course, they eat mice, and mice, they just hate bears because they eat mice, so they don't like each other, but it's only prejudice and stuff like that, and it's how Ernest and Celestine just don't care about all those prejudices and start to live together because they just love creating, drawing, and making music together. So it's what he wanted to make in the film.
Now, one thing that happens in the film is that the mice have the job of collecting teeth, sort of like tooth fairies in more anglophonic cultures. Yeah. Is that an actual tradition in French society, the tooth mice?
Yeah. Well, we don't have a tooth fairy, we have a tooth mice. It's when we lose a tooth, we have to put it under our pillow, and the next morning we have a coin instead of a tooth. But to be honest, when I was a kid, they told me that, but once I woke up in the middle of the night and I saw a huge hand, very hairy hand, putting a coin instead of my... So I had doubts. I thought it was bears or something, but actually it was my father's hand. It was... He's very hairy. And but the in France, the tradition is that it's mice coming with the tooth.
Oh, and there's a scene in the film in which it's a very ironic moment because the bear parents are telling their cub about the tooth mouse and how wonderful it is. And when the real mouse, Celestine, shows up, she scares the tar out of him.
Yeah, there's something like this logical of a very... There's this guy who is a very wealthy sailor, and he wants to make money out of everything. So